It is the 2nd of December, I think, and this is our final cybercrime class of the semester. Thank you. I appreciate that. Okay. So there were a couple of interesting stories relevant to some of the things we've discussed this semester that I thought I'd share with you to begin with. You may recall when we talked about the surveillance issues, the NSA and et cetera, and one of the possibilities that I raised with you was that we'd have slow internet. No, was that it was a real challenge to decide, or could be a real challenge to decide in terms of whether or not there was probable cause and a warrant if, in the case of an investigation, I don't know why this is doing what it's doing. Okay, whatever it is. Hold on half a second. Sorry about this. In the case of the investigation, say, for child pornography, that potentially the information driving the investigation came from a warrantless wiretap. And whether that would even be known to a potential defendant and accused in order to challenge the ultimate arrest. Well, lo and behold, part of the Snowden documents we learned is that among the other things that the NSA was looking at were the pornography viewing habits of those whom they were surveilling. And if you could see what I can see, which is the highlighted part here, some of the vulnerabilities, that is, the distinctions between surveillance subjects, public and private behavior, if exposed, would likely call into question a radicalizer's devotion to the jihadist cause, leading to the degradation or loss of his authority. And examples of some of these vulnerabilities include viewing sexually explicit material online or using sexually explicit persuasive language when communicating with inexperienced young girls. That is the highlight. So this is not specifically about prosecuting child pornography, but it's fairly clear that, yeah, they were looking for accessing pornography generally, and one can certainly envision that whether or not they discovered that this was a radical whom they wished to, again, radical in air quotes, whom they wished to discredit, the idea that they were viewing these things that were at least seemingly unrelated to national security issues, collecting that information and potentially acting on it. And without this revelation from Edward Snowden, we wouldn't know. So imagine you're a lawyer representing a client accused of viewing child pornography, and the police can't tell you where they got the tip. Or rather, they may not tell you where they got the tip, because in fact, the source for the tip was a warrantless wiretap from the NSA. What can you do with that as a lawyer? Not sure what, if there is anything you can do, but understand this is not hypothetical. We have at least, I don't want to call it proof, but we have evidence via the Snowden leaks that in fact the NSA was looking, among other things, for porn viewing habits. And then came this story from Cory Doctorow's Boing Boing website. Again, very, very relevant to what we've been discussing, specifically talking about spyware and malware, and whether or not the EULA, which is the End User License Agreement, if you get into any sort of software law, you will be very familiar with EULA. I'm sure there are lawyers who have probably named their daughters EULA just because. But This is a really interesting story. It came out yesterday. Researchers at Malwarebytes discovered that some programs covertly install Bitcoin mining software on users' computers, papering over the practice, you'll pardon the expression, by including sneaky language in their license agreements allowing for computer calculations security. And this is the language specifically, at least according to this article. As part of downloading a mutual public, which is the name of the software, your computer may do mathematical calculations for our affiliated networks to confirm transactions and increase security. Any rewards or fees collected by WBT or our affiliates are the sole property of WBT and our affiliates. What's that all about? Could someone explain, first of all, generally speaking, what Bitcoin is and what Bitcoin mining is? You guys want to fight this now? Go for it. Quickly, loudly.
Bitcoin's an online cryptocurrency that you can get a number of ways, but one way you can go about them is by buying.
We need to backtrack. You're saying an online cryptocurrency, not all that helpful.
Sorry, I think it's brief.
Well, yes, but brief but clear.
It's basically a currency that a lot of people in the tech world are treating as like money, and they buy and sell things on it. They trade it like a commodity or something like stuff. It's value. I think it's like $1,200 right now for a Bitcoin. Last summer it was $85. Like this one. And you can mine them.
Well, all right. Let's stop with that. So, a Bitcoin. First of all, thank you. Much simpler, very helpful. A Bitcoin is virtual money. It's not any country's money. It's not tied to a game, World of Warcraft, or anything else. It just free flows. And it was established to be as close as possible to the digital equivalent of cash. And I think we have discussed Bitcoins a little bit. What makes Bitcoins particularly interesting and potentially valuable is that there's an upward limit on the total number of Bitcoins that will ever be in circulation. 21 million coins. And the way that they have limited this is in order to mine, to create a new Bitcoin that you can use, you've got to go through a rather complicated series of computing calculations. And the more Bitcoins in circulation, the more complicated the computing has to be to mine another one. So now most people who are involved in using Bitcoins, etc., are buying them and selling them and exchanging them for real money in one way or another through exchanges. But it's still possible to create new Bitcoins and then turn them into $1,200 per whatever it is. So what people do to mine Bitcoins is they network lots of computers together to share the processing of these very, very complex calculations. What have these people done? Well, what they've essentially done is buried a Bitcoin peer-to-peer mining operation into software that people are using. Interestingly enough, what kind of software is it? It is your free proxy. So people who are, oh, I want to be anonymous on the internet, free proxy, I could do this and etc. But it's also installed, think about those malware cases and those spyware cases. This isn't spying on people. And it's not per se damaging their computers. But what it's doing is, without really disclosing it, it's using their computing power to help create new Bitcoins for the software developers. And the users get nothing. Get nothing out of it. Is that a cyber crime? Is it malware? What do you think? Well, does that tell you what they're doing? Your computer, What it says is your computer may do mathematical calculations for our affiliated networks to confirm transactions and increase security. Does Bitcoin mining confirm a transaction or increase security in any logical A to B way? That's the question. It's not that there's no agreement. It's that the agreement they're providing is about as subtle, misleading, pick your adjective, as it could be. Think about the cases we read, the malware case, where the court looked at the agreement and said, you know what, whether or not people read the agreement, it's there, it's clear, we're very explicit about what it's doing, what it's installing, you're choosing to do so or not. The point of this story here is that that process really isn't occurring. It would be very difficult to take these words and argue that even people who read this would understand that what was going on was their computers were being utilized by somebody else to mine bitcoins. Is it criminal? Hard to say. What might be the crime there of the ones we've discussed? Or even the civil action? Suppose it depends on how much of the computer's power it's using. If the calculations are sufficiently in depth that the computer's functioning is very degraded. Think back, for example, if you recall when we discussed the Robert Tappan Morris Jr. internet worm, that very early either security example or malicious shutdown, the way he brought down the internet was by running so many copies of his program on each one of the internet's servers that they could do nothing else. They had no processor power left to actually function. It's not suggesting here that these Bitcoin processes do that, but nor do we know how much they're slowing down your computer. And how much is too much before you've got, whether it's a trespass to chattels, whether you can make one of the 18 U.S.C. 1030, are they exceeding authorization? They're accessing a protected computer, well, it's connected to the internet, so we're past that. Without authorization, no, probably not. Exceeding authorization, yeah, maybe. And what's the end? As a lawyer, probably a class action lawyer, you might well be trying to make that case and looking at the different 18 U.S.C. 1030 and determining whether there might be some sort of claim. But in any event, the defenses that we've seen, specifically the it's in the license agreement, may in fact not apply here. Thought it was a very timely article. Okay. Reminder quickly of the exam as we voted and determined as scheduled, 19th of December, 2 p.m. to 5 p.m. in class. There will be 7 essay questions. You will have to choose any 4 that you that you want, that you think you have the best shot at answering. It is open paper materials. And if you have questions between now and then, email me. We can set up a time to chat, or we can just talk or communicate by email. I don't know whether, I'm not really sure, although we've used the same syllabus, how much our discussions have paralleled those of the other cybercrime section. I don't know whether the exams will be the same. I'm still discussing it with Professor Zachrin. So, while I don't think there's any harm, to the extent that any of you is study partners with someone who's in the other section, I don't think there's any harm in you jointly studying. But I cannot say for certain whether you will ultimately be tested in the same way and then on the same materials, because we've discussed different things. Any questions on this? Just a quick few reminders on this. One, again, if you're handwriting, please work on being legible. Add spaces, skip lines, let me read what you say and not have to translate it first. Work as hard as you can given the time on your writing overall. Do not recite what I've told you. Show me what you think. And make sure, please, make sure you have answered 4 different questions. Some questions may have multiple parts. That doesn't count. You have to answer the questions that are asked. So make sure you each one you look at and say, what are all the things I'm being asked? But if you don't give me answers to 4 separate questions, the best you could do on the exam is a 75. Don't do that to me. I'll feel very offended. Seriously, I've had to do it. It kills me. But that's it, in order to be fair. Make sure you leave yourself enough time to answer 4 full questions and 4 questions fully. I should also note, we have been, as you know, very focused on the bar exam. We always are, all the more so now. I think some of you may have gotten some discussions with the dean. You've certainly seen the news. We had a workshop last week for the faculty, specifically those faculty members who are teaching the first year core courses, to try to implement more evaluative measures, more ways of evaluating people earlier on that track how the bar exam evaluates. And lo and behold, we got examples. And what are they? Fact patterns where you have to spot the issues and then write essays answering the specific questions. In other words, even though this is not a bar course and that mandate doesn't apply here, I was gratified, I should say, to see that the way I'm evaluating you, the way you are taking this exam, is what you're going to see on the bar exam. It is that type of question. So if you've been looking at those bar type questions in other classes, you should know, if you want to see the way I ask the questions, go to the cyber law exam. We were told that the bar does not try to throw in any red herrings. They're very straightforward. I'm not making that promise. I'm not going to try to fool you, but more to the point, there may be subtleties there. The bar's pretty straightforward. What can I tell you? All right. So let's talk about the final topic on our syllabus, and hopefully we'll leave some time for exam review, and hopefully you may even have some questions. So, again, the word crimes is somewhat of a vague one, because these aren't always criminal in their violation. Sometimes you'll see civil actions, but ultimately, these kinds of things, what is it? What is the common thread? Take out the word cyber. Well, you shouldn't, because otherwise you can't answer the question. So, what are the common threads across cyberbullying, threats, stalking, in this context, harassment, and defamation? What do they involve? What don't they involve? Is bullying unique to the internet? Did it exist before? Yeah, of course it did. Were people making threats? Or did you have stalkers pre-internet? Sure you did. Did people harass other people? Did they defame other people? Absolutely. But what makes it different online? What are the characteristics here that are shared? Potentially. Potentially you've got a broader viewing audience. Offline, you've got only those people who are nearby. Online could theoretically be the world. It doesn't have to be. It may be still very direct one-to-one, but yes, absolutely. What else? What other characteristics are shared with these types of behaviors? Yeah.
The lasting effects of being online.
Explain that. You're right. And not only kept online, not only is it there, but what? What is it about things that are online? They're findable, aren't they? That if your future employer or prospective romantic partner or law school, board of bar examiners, whatever it is, they're looking you up, and you, like I, have a somewhat searchable name, it's entirely possible that along with your awards and honors and the things that you've posted, the threats, the defamation may last. So there is a certain lasting potential, lasting and searchable quality to these things. What else? Anonymity or pseudonymity. It is a lot harder. Just think about it. 50 or 100 years ago, what did harassers, threateners, or assailants do? Think about the people who were intimidating others. Think about, for example, the Ku Klux Klan as one sort of broad example of people who got their jollies threatening and harassing others. How did they somewhat establish anonymity? They put on masks, they put on hoods, right? How do criminals establish anonymity? They put on masks. You don't need a mask online. You need a username. And it's not always, sometimes it's not even a username, sometimes it's just somebody else's name. It's a lot easier, at least initially, as we've discussed before, to have anonymity, pseudonymity online. Is it perfect? No. There are methods, techniques for finding out, for identifying at least the account used. But you're right. And what does that do? What does the availability of anonymity do to a potential harasser, bully? So what will that do to them? It'll make it more likely, right? It'll empower them. It will encourage people to, they'll be more likely to give in to these impulses if they have less chance of being caught, of being identified, of being stigmatized. What else? Very true. You're right. It's very easy, but let's focus on the word pain. What don't these assaults do? What aren't they? They're not physical. That's a really key point here. Unless you have the ability to maliciously hack into somebody's computer and make it explode, or their X-ray machine and, you know, boost the output 100,000-fold, which is a really frightening concept, not that far from possible. But unless you do something like that, or you take over the nearest, you know, vacuum cleaner robot and have it attack them, whatever it is, these are all words. But that doesn't mean they're not harmful. They may be psychologically harmful. They may be financially harmful. And the law has long recognized the destructive power of words. Yes, we have a First Amendment, particularly right here in this in the United States. We haven't focused on the First Amendment so much in this class. And the First Amendment does say, generally, Congress shall establish, you know, pass no law infringing on, I'm not quoting it right, but the freedom of speech. But that has never been understood to prohibit governments from at least regulating defamatory speech and some other kinds of speech that are directly harmful. Now, it doesn't mean that there are no controls. The Constitution does apply here. And so you get a balance in any law, civil or criminal, any law regulating speech. You have to demonstrate that it's not simply words, that there is a harm. When we look at threats, the key there is a credible threat. It's not, I'm gonna kill you, but I'm going to kill you. And I'm going to kill you at this time, in this manner. And you believe me, because I've killed before. Isn't that? Thank you very much, credible threats. Cyberbullying, now that's, what is that? What is cyberbullying? Bullying really does, as a general matter, bring with it at least the actuality or imminent possibility of physical harm. Not always. I've long maintained that the most evil population in the world is 8th grade girls. They are the cruel women, yes? I think, but by freshman year, they're always already the youngest, right? 8th grade girls has, now my daughter's in 7th grade, and I know she will be an exception to this rule. But 8th grade girls have the capability of cruelty, of capacity for cruelty that I've never seen. They could give warlords a lesson. Yes, women? You know what I'm talking about. You remember, hopefully you, none of you, of course, was one of those. You were also exceptions to every single one. I see it in your hearts. But, now it isn't often that those that comes with physical violence. They're not, tend to be the strongest people in the world. But the psychological harm, the ostracism, it's just phenomenal. It's unbelievable. Now give them the power of anonymity and a worldwide audience. And you begin to see where the actual harms, and we have stories, we know these stories. They become movies of the week and Law and Order episodes and real world tragedies of young girls. Notice how old they are, right? 7th and 8th grade girls largely, who are so psychologically damaged by the taunting, the bullying, that they commit suicide. It happens over and over again. These two girls in Florida, against whom the law enforcement officials recently chose not to bring charges for cyberbullying in the death of a classmate. One was repentant, one was very much not. It isn't that words aren't harmful, they absolutely are. And the law recognizes that. Some things more than others. Cyberbullying, that is sort of a direct, active assault, verbal assault. Threats, harder to differentiate between constitutionally protected and not. Stalking, even harder to discover. I mean, is searching out your potential date on Google stalking? What about your former significant others? What about everyone they've ever dated? What about their dogs? You know, at some point, research becomes a bit much. And why generally speaking, as much as we're joking about it, why is stalking recognized by the law? What's the difference between stalking and being a fan? But sometimes you know you have fans who then are stalkers. What do stalkers do that fans don't? Well, fans do also. Then what? They might, so might fans. Because stalkers end up harming people. Stalkers have no filter on the difference between being a fan and being psychologically obsessed. There are, I mean, again, case upon case of actors and actresses, largely celebrities usually, who are killed by their stalkers. This woman who, how many times did she go into David Letterman's house over the years? Go look it up. He had this stalker for years. And the law does recognize that at some point there's a difference between engaged fan and potentially hostile person. But all of these differentiations are very, very difficult because of the Constitution. Because speech is protected. And there's no question that online speech is protected just as offline speech is protected. That's not up for discussion. And if it weren't freedom of the speech, then it would essentially be freedom of the press, and you'd get to the same place. You don't have to speak for your speech to be recognized and constitutionally protected. And so in all of these circumstances, the courts have to wrestle with, well, first, to the extent that you have legislation, the legislators have to wrestle with the idea, may they, are they constitutionally permitted to legislate in this area? Is what they're trying to prohibit, as bad as it is, still constitutionally protected? And if what they do turns out to be constitutionally protected, or what they legislate against, then the first time a police officer or district attorney, whatever it is, tries to indict someone and prosecute someone based on that law, the defense attorney will challenge its constitutionality and win. So they really, it is a constant effort. We see this as a harm, but the Constitution says some things, although they may potentially be felt as harmful, are nevertheless protected. And so as we read these laws, as we read these cases, we really have to consider that balancing, that line, and it's not a clean, bright line, between constitutionally protected speech, however offensive it may be, however objectionable, however hurtful it may be, and that speech which is no longer protected by the Constitution. Do we need new laws here? Why do we need a new law for online stalking if there might be a law for offline stalking? Any thoughts given the kinds of laws that we've seen, the new laws? What sort of activity might offline stalking, how might it be described in the law? If you were writing an anti-stalker law, talking about physical stalking, What kinds of activities would you prohibit? What? Trespass, although trespass may already be prohibited, but maybe the same way you would with hate crimes, you would ascribe intent to trespass or multiple trespass. But what is trespass? It's a physical act. It's moving on to someone else's real property. That has no relevance in the internet. Approaching within X number of feet after being told not to. Again, perfectly rational in the offline world, completely useless, meaningless in the online world. Cyberbullying is not getting three or four other people online who are bigger than the person. Doesn't necessarily have to threaten physical harm. What's a credible threat? Well, in the real world, a credible threat will likely start with this person is either in front of me or nearby and has the physical and or weapon capabilities to harm me. You know, the little yappy dog might bark at you a lot, but unless it's rabid, it is not a credible threat for real harm. The little two-year-old, now they're perhaps, you know, he or she can get in a lucky shot, but by him or herself, not whatever he or she threatens is not a credible threat. But that has to do with physical ability. When you're online, you have no way to judge. So if the standard for, what would you call it? Maybe it's assault. Right? Maybe this was just one of those TV things. But I believe that assault doesn't necessarily require physical contact, right? It doesn't. But it's the credible threat of physical harm. That has zero relevance, or not the zero relevance, but the standards for evaluating the credibility of that threat are totally different. And so if the statute is written based on, you know, physical proximity or difference in physical size or view visible weaponry, none of that will be applicable directly to the online world. Think back when we've had to deal with issues of theft. And what is theft when both the robber and the victim still have the thing? Because you've made a copy. Here too, the reason you might need new law is A, the standards for evaluating whatever it is are different if they're physical versus non-physical. And B, you've got jurisdictional questions. Because it's very hard to bully someone from three states or a country away. Cyberbullying, not so much. It's very hard for a teenager's mother, outside of some 21 Jump Street remake, you know, to credibly pretend to be another teenager. Or especially a teenage boy. Real hard to pull that off. Online, no problem whatsoever. Or much easier, I should say. So you may need new law either because the circumstances surrounding this potential for harm are different, or the ability to harm is different, or because the harm itself. Think about sort of the cyber extortion, the threat against data. That might not fit under the traditional definitions of extortion. Threat against personal property, a threat against self. It's data, our data, but they have their own value, and so we have separate laws for cyber extortion. So we have these separate laws. So let's take a look. One of the laws that our text discusses is a Michigan law. In the cyberbullying context, Michigan law, it is actually from the penal code, compiled laws, penal code, 750.411S. Posting messages through electronic medium without consent. A person shall not post a message through the use of any medium of communication, including the internet or a computer, computer program, computer system, or computer network, or any electronic medium of communication without the victim's consent if all of the following apply. The person knows or has reason to know that posting the message could cause two or more separate non-continuous act of unconsented contact with the victim. Posting the message is intended to cause conduct that would make the victim feel terrorized, frightened, intimidated, threatened, harassed, or molested. Conduct arising from posting the message would cause a reasonable person to suffer emotional distress and to feel terrorized, frightened, intimidated, threatened, harassed, or molested. Conduct arising from posting the message causes the victim to suffer emotional distress and to feel terrorized, frightened, intimidated, threatened, harassed, or molested. What the heck does that mean? We have most of it in the book. What is that talking about? How is what we just read together bullying? Anybody have any sense? You need to be able to read these types of statutes, and you have it there on page 578 in relevant part. What does this mean when you're reading it? As I know you all were. What did you think it meant? Anyone want to take a shot at this? Or I call on someone at random? Ovia, any thoughts? Well, you do have more than one, yes. Two or more separate continue, but...
Also, what struck out to me is the IIED aspect
of it. The IIED?
Well, the emotional...
Intentional infliction of emotional distress. Okay. But it's not just emotional distress, necessarily. Yeah, except that I'm looking at this. Posting the message is intended to cause conduct that would make the victim feel terrorized, and conduct arising from posting the message causes the victim to suffer emotional distress. And so what does that mean, conduct? This is not simply, why is this bullying and not insulting? What's the conduct? It doesn't talk about that. It says conduct. What kind of conduct? Well, it's not simply a reaction, or maybe it is, but it's activity. It's incitement. It's intending. Think about what you've learned, generally speaking, about First Amendment protection of political speech. Where is that line drawn? What kind of political speech is not constitutionally protected? The type of political speech that is intended to incite violence, right? You've heard this? Incitement. You can criticize the government all you want. Once you call for armed revolution, and you mean it, you've sort of stepped over the constitutionally protected line. Similarly here, this is not simply insulting someone. This is not simply trying to cause them emotional distress. This is intending to evoke conduct and actually causing conduct that results in this. This is calling for things to happen, having them happen, and having this harm occur. That's why it's cyberbullying. Hey, everybody, let's go to X's house and do something. Next time you see X, kick her. Right? Let's all, you know, do X this in the locker room to X. Posting that message online, calling for this conduct that has the potential to make a feeling, it's intended to cause conduct that would make the victim feel terrorized, frightened, intimidated, threatened, harassed, or molested, and it does, and that feeling results. It's a really, on one level, it's a high standard to meet. Yep.
So A through D all have to be
That's correct. That's why I say it's a very high standard. And by the way, if the victim consents, nothing occurs.
That's the other question I had. My mom is a school teacher and she deals with a lot of this kind of stuff with bullying. Is there just logically it just makes sense that a lot of these kids go through bullying for like months and months and sometimes over a year? Like the Facebook posts and especially like retweeting and everything. Why do you just block this?
Define block. What does that mean?
To not allow the person to see your post on your profile.
But again, who gets to see it?
Yeah, I just mean that that seems.
So you've got the bullier and the bullied. So if the bully doesn't see what the bullier is telling others, how does that help all the rest of this? La la la, whoops. La la la, I don't want to know that what you're saying that you've just told all these other people to harass me. Doesn't say that the victim has to know. It's still, whether or not the victim knows he or she is being targeted. If the bully intends to target the victim, and does, and it's effective, but blocking doesn't mean that the bully is blocked, is stopped from saying this. It simply means that one or more people don't hear it, don't see it, but all the other intended co-bullies might see it. The entire school could see it. And if someone who the victim hasn't quote-unquote blocked reposts it, then the victim will see it too. That is an ineffective method. It's an ineffective method.
I was just
consent is not that. Consent is, let's try something. You know, like, go ahead, I dare you to post it. I'm not sure in this context what consent means. But at least they seem to acknowledge that the victim could consent. And therefore, the victim will no longer have a claim. I'm not sure what that situation would be. But think about all the levels here. It's a challenge. And, it's intended, right? You know it could. You intended to. You do it. And the harm is caused. And that, if you look at this statute, again, that's what's on 578. Intent, knowledge, intention, action, result. And all of those, yeah. It does seem to. So this does, you're right. That is one element of this. That the standard by which this conduct would be judged is not by, because, and particularly because this is emotional distress, and it's not just emotional distress. It's emotional distress and feeling terrorized, frightened, intimidated, threatened, harassed, or molested, as a reasonable person would. So think about the three-year-olds. You know, one three-year-old says to two other three-year-olds, let's go kill him. Now, it's cute until somebody's dad left a gun locker, you know, it happens, but it's unlikely. You know? So, yeah, there's a reasonability, and I suspect, again, think about the constitutional hoops that the drafters of this law have to jump through because it is driven by speech. Without that speech element, this becomes assault. But everything online is speech. And with everything online being speech, the only way to regulate it is with the First Amendment fully in mind and in full compliance of it. And it's only in issues of intentional incitement, which is really what this is, and successful intentional incitement. Now, this is a state law. And as the book notes, it's not simply about schools. And if you go through this statute, you see which kinds of behaviors are aggravating offenses. If you violate your parole posting it, if you post the message and it results in a credible threat being communicated to the victim, a member of the victim's family, or another individual living in the same household of the victim. The victim is less than 18 years of age when the violation is committed, and the person committing the violation is 5 or more years older than the victim. It does, interestingly enough, just as the federal law does, it does excuse from liability the computer network that was used. Just by virtue of communicating, facilitating the communication does not make one also responsible. And whether or not this said this, if you look up section 47 U.S.C. 230, which I think we looked at with some of the spam laws, but the main thrust of 47 U.S.C. section 230 is a broad safe harbor, a broad immunization for service providers for liability arising out of content, messages posted by third parties. Well, here actually we have a definition if you go later on, by the way, to the question of consent. Unconsented contact means any contact with another individual that is initiated. Well, that's not the content of messages. Let's see if we define consent itself. Very interesting things. So they're trying. They know that, you know, the legislatures understand that this is not a new impulse, but a new methodology for causing this type of harm. And it's a methodology which, on the one hand, is not as direct and physical, but on the other hand, is a hell of a lot harder to prevent, a hell of a lot harder to detect, and a hell of a lot harder to punish. And so we have a specific crime dealing with online bullying because of these different elements. That it is entirely speech-based. That it can be from a distance. That it can be potentially anonymous or pseudonymous, at least at first. That it can be done by anyone to anyone. And that, as virtual as it may be, it has very real potential for emotional damage and feeling threatened, feeling harassed, etc. So we have a number of cases. And again, the cases run through a variety of jurisdictions, a variety of time frames, a variety of versions of the law. We have this New York criminal case people versus Mun. And what was the message posted on a Usenet news group? Please kill Police Lieutenant Stephen Beagle, all other NYPD cops, and all of their adult relatives and friends. It was polite. It said please. And what was the statute that was invoked? Here we have a New York law. New York Penal Law, Section 240.30, as it currently is drafted. Aggravated harassment, criminal harassment, in the second degree. Someone is guilty of this when he or she, with intent to harass, annoy, threaten, or alarm another person, he or she either, well, here's what we have here, communicates with a person anonymously or otherwise by telegraph, telephone, telegraph, or by mail, or by transmitting or delivering any other form of written communication in a manner likely to cause annoyance or alarm, or causes a communication to be initiated by mechanical or electronic means or otherwise with a person anonymously or otherwise by telegraph, by telephone, by telegraph, or by mail, or by transmitting or delivering any other form of written communication in a manner likely to cause annoyance or alarm. That's the statute. As it currently written. And it's been somewhat changed. So what happens here? The court finds what? That the elements of the statute are met, even though the statute was drafted pre-internet. It was posted on a news group. It was posted publicly. What were the challenges that the court faced there with the definitions? Because that's what this is about. Again, pre-internet statute being invoked for an internet-related offense. What are the elements here? What are the challenges? Right. Now, interestingly, the statute has somewhat been amended. Not entirely addressing those issues. And so the telephone yeah, it does seem that, doesn't it? Well,
that last sentence in there, when transmitting or delivering any form of written communication in a manner likely to cause annoyance or alarm, it's giving the option of taking out the telephone or telegraph or by mail.
Right, right. Notice the important change. The important change post this case was that before it said by telephone, by telegraph, mail, or any other form of written communication. Now it says, by telephone, by telegraph, or by mail, or by transmitting or delivering any other form of written communication. So if it's in writing, even if it isn't by telephone, by telegraph, or by mail, now the court doesn't have to wrestle with that. What was the other part? It wasn't a message to him. It was a message about him. And they've split it into two now, but it's essentially the same. Communicates with a person or causes a communication to be initiated. So what does that mean, causes a communication to be initiated? How do you cause a communication to be initiated? What do we have here? Did our defendant actually write a letter to Police Lieutenant Stephen Beagle? Right, and he saw it. Right? If your name is up there, you're going to see it or hear about it. And so, notice that what's important about this case is, as with so many other the other cases we've looked at throughout the entire semester, not the law per se, because the law has changed. But notice how hard it is for the court to answer the threshold question. Does this law even apply to this particular circumstance? Because the circumstance was basically someone calling or mailing a threat to someone. And that was one-to-one. But now we have this idea of one-to-many. Using this medium the drafters of this statute, as we hear, when it was drafted in 1969, they had no idea. Wow, we have a citation to Judge Wachtler here. But notice what isn't true here. What about a YouTube video? Would a YouTube video making the same claim be covered by this statute as written, even as written here? No. At least not the first paragraph. Why not? What's different between a YouTube message and a Usenet message?
Written.
Because this statute, even now, specifies written content, the identical message spoken aloud on a video would not be prosecutable. Now, there might well be another statute that applies to this. But by making this drafting choice, New York legislators have excluded from at least this particular other forms of harassment delivered in the same way to the same audience. But an audio recording wouldn't count, a video recording wouldn't count, a little animation showing what should be done, it just wouldn't count. And there may well be another statute, but one could see someone getting away with this simply by the choice of methodology. Now we have a federal case, U.S. v. Alcabaz. And this is an odd case. Can someone help us with the facts of Alcabaz? Go ahead. Tell us about Alcabaz.
So Alcabaz and another...
Let's start where we are and at what trial level.
It's a United States federal case.
Yes, it is. But what level?
Sixth Circuit.
So that's an appeals court.
Correct.
Right? So what happened at the trial level?
At the trial level,
Was there a conviction? Alcabaz, a.k.a. Jake Baker, was he convicted? First paragraph of the case.
Yeah.
No, he wasn't. They're appealing the dismissal of the indictment. So what was the law with which he was charged? Which said at that point what? Right, shall be fined under this title. Okay, so this is about making a threat. And as we've said, and as we see in this case, the challenge here is whether it's a credible threat. What did Baker do?
He had conversations with this guy in Ontario about meeting up and having sex with the girls that are hired.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
I guess like the person in Canada, like Red Men, they started like a communication or whatever it's called.
What was the specific threat? From where did the specific threat in the portion of the case we have arise? Right. That's the alleged threat. It wasn't that he was saying, I like to do these horrific things. That's not a threat. It's not a particularly socially acceptable thing to say. It's nice to know, but that's not the threat. That all is there as evidence of his state of mind. Threats have to be against a particular person. Any person, or the person, the body of another individual. And where in the indictment, from where was that named person threat derived? From a story that he posted, again, to Usenet. See, if you don't know about Usenet, you miss all the really good and bad stuff. Because Usenet, of course, he was in college. Even today, Usenet is probably still mostly used by college types and the old techies among us. But he posted this story. It was not posted as a diary entry. It wasn't a confession. It was quite explicitly, you'll pardon the pun, a story. But what made it a potential threat was he put a real woman's name into it. One of his classmates at the University of Michigan. Go Wolverine. Right? The Wolverines, right? I don't want to insult Michigan State people if I get that wrong. So that was the question. Is this a credible threat? What does the court say? What does the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals say? No. I love the quote. We agree with the district court that, quote, whatever Baker's fault, and he is to be faulted, he did not violate 18 U.S.C. 875C. We have a dissent, though. The dissent was what?
Troubling.
Troubling how?
Well, I read the conversations.
Yes. So it's not that the dissent was troubling.
Correct.
In the dissent, we find out how skeezy this guy really was. And he believed, this judge, in writing the dissent, believed that a jury could infer, in light of the evidence, that he intended the foreseeable, natural, ordinary consequences of his voluntary actions. Now, what were the actions that this statute prohibits? Were they the rape? Was this about rape? It was about a credible threat. And so the dissenting judge felt that there was the possibility of a credible threat. But the majority here, as the district court had found before it, read this was not, as much as you may be including real people, as he may be including a real person in his fiction, especially given that all that other stuff was not publicly accessible. The correspondence between Baker and Gonda was not publicly posted. It was evidence that was found during the investigation. It would have been relevant to trial, but the student, and maybe, I think this is really where it turns, that the student, as horrified as she clearly would have been to find her name and this idea of permanence, right? The idea of things on the internet staying on the internet. Imagine being this woman, because Usenet archives are still there. And it would be an interesting question. Do we have any text that we can actually put into Google? I don't think the case gives us any actual phrasing. But the story may well be up there still. And it may be findable, and it may have her name in it. And imagine that comes up in a Google search. But that's not criminal. Yeah. Well, it doesn't, it's not all that convoluted. Think back to our discussion of earlier in the class. That you post something, again, different circumstance, that has the intention of causing action. Or think back to this police officer case. Ultimately, even though it wasn't sent to him, his name was in it. And he could see that, and the court found in New York, that was a credible threat. You don't have, even though she didn't see it, her name was in it, it was findable. She had, ultimately, just as the police officer did, she did hear about it. She just didn't see it because she wasn't frequenting those Usenet news groups. Okay. So that shouldn't matter so much, and it doesn't here. But what matters here is that the credibility, that absent anything else, there was nothing, you know, she certainly had the right to feel insulted, offended, skeeved out, wanting to stay as far away from this guy as possible. But she didn't have anything else to know whether or not he intended it, and we don't know that. He may have just had really, really sick fantasies. What? Excuse me? Okay. Okay.
And federal prosecutor, I'm sorry, the New York prosecutor, was able to convince the court that, although that what he's quoting would be his words and the fantasy, that he went over the line and basically it was like a conspiracy.
Okay. Right. Now, a document found on his wife's laptop was titled Abducting and Cooking Kimberly, a Blueprint. It included a photograph of Kimberly Sauer and personal information, including her bra size and shoe size, although some of it was inaccurate. It listed materials leading. Now, this was not written in the context of, and here it said there were three co-conspirators. Court records show that Val got the addresses of his alleged targets by sending them a police charity card that he claimed would get them out of a minor traffic violation. So, he provide they the difference seems to be one difference seems to be is that what we have in the Alcabets case, where did Baker post his story? He posted the story in a Usenet group called alt.sex.stories. It was there, not as, you know, this wasn't like the Penthouse Forum column. Let me tell you about this thing that really happened to me. No, this was a forum for fiction, sexually explicit fiction, but fiction. And that forum sets a context. I don't know that in our Cannibal Cop story, whether or not he ultimately described them as stories, he had the same level of, I'm putting them publicly in a database of stories. Also, he was a cop. And he used a federal law enforcement database to get information on his victims. Remember our case about the IRS official in Boston who was accused of computer crime because he had the right to access the IRS database for his job, but he did it to get information on people he didn't agree with, but he didn't do anything with it, right? So here we have whether, you know, what crime was he necessarily, he was convicted of kidnap conspiracy. He was also found guilty of illegally accessing a federal law enforcement database. That might be the cybercrime. He exceeded his authorization in order potentially to further a crime or accessed information. That's clearly not the worst crime they got him on. But the difference is here, it was not posted to an expressly fictional website. He was not communicating generally about his interests with these people, but about specific potential victims by name with these people. He had access to and utilized, not in published stories, University of Michigan, home address, bra size, very specific, the amount of detail, the amount of planning, the amount of conspiracy. No, he wasn't convicted on kidnapping or cannibalism or murder, merely on conspiracy, but they were able to make the case. So yeah, it was a very similar situation. I'm glad you raised it, but you see the differences, but also the statute under which he was convicted. In Baker, they weren't going after him on a kidnap or a conspiracy charge. Maybe they chose the wrong statute, but that was the one they had him on, probably because they didn't have the kind of evidence they had against this police officer. So we have Baker, the author, and Val, the cannibal cop. The joy of the tabloids. State versus Ellison, Ohio case. Telecommunications harassment. She posted in as a teenager. Well, they had a fallout during seventh grade, okay. So in high school, our defendant posted on her internet MySpace page a picture of her former friend that was captioned, "Molested a little boy," and stated in her personal profile she hated the other woman. And she was charged with telecommunications harassment. So that was the, no person shall make or cause to be made a telecommunication or permit a telecommunication to be made from a telecommunications device under the person's control with the purpose to abuse, threaten, or harass another person. And what was the result of this case? What did the Ohio Court of Appeals determine in this case with regard to Ellison?
It was a
She did, that's correct. She did not communicate, and more to the point, she didn't, they didn't establish that her intention was to harass. And she didn't communicate directly. So what was this then? What could this have been other than criminal harassment? Could be defamation, civil defamation. Calling someone a child molester is defamation per se. Generally speaking, under state law, calling someone, stating that someone has committed a crime, not thinking that person could be a criminal, looks like a criminal, this person has committed a crime. Making that statement as a fact, generally speaking, is defamation per se. It's a civil action. And Gerhard could have, and perhaps did, sue Ellison for defamation. But what it wasn't was criminal harassment as defined by Ohio statute. And the concurring judge says, it is a scary thought that someone could go to jail for posting a comment on the internet. If so, we could not build jails fast enough. The statute on telecommunications harassment is the successor to the former telephone harassment law. It is designed to prohibit harassing or threatening calls, but posting an annoying but non-threatening comment on a website is not a crime under this statute. It might well be a civil wrong, but it is not jailable. The First Amendment would not allow punishment for making a non-threatening comment on the internet, just as it would not for writing a newspaper article, posting a sign, or speaking on the radio. Exactly. Exactly. AB versus State. Again with the MySpace. AB was a student at middle school. Ha! Huh? Middle school girl. See? There it is. AB created a fake profile of Mr. Gobert that was alleging that she used a computer network to harass Mr. Gobert. Die, Gobert, die. F star star K, Mr. Gobert, and GC Schools. And she was convicted as a juvenile, as a delinquent child, which might just simply have been a commentary. But no. And what does the Indiana court do here? What is the result of this case? I'm sorry, I can't hear you. Right? Right. And how was it that he saw it? Right. That, and we have, if you recall, there was the Hawaiian Conup case, I think we read earlier in the semester. The Hawaiian Airlines website for employees, which was supposed to be only by non-management, and management accessed it because one of the employees gave the management person a password. And that case was about whether that was exceeding authorization or without authorization. Here too, not meant for Mr. Gobert's viewing, but somebody gave him the password and he saw it. So the offense of harassment, we're told, a person must have the intent to harass, annoy, or alarm another person but with no intent of legitimate communication. RB, made a harmless joke profile for Mr. Gobert, and I'm reading quote here, "Some retarded bitch printed it out and took it to the office. RB is expelled, has to go to court. Mike has to go to girls' school and has to take the eighth grade over again. That's just from the school. Her parents have grounded her, took her computer. She can't be online until 2007. GMS is full of overreacting idiots. So, stupid, yes. Annoying, yes. Criminal harassment, no. Another New York case, Kochanowski. Aggravated harassment in the second degree. Created an anonymous website to negatively depict a complainant, a person with whom he had shared a prior relationship. And early, it wasn't quite revenge porn, but the coworker, he had a helper. At one or two points within the webpage, defendant asked him, that is his, the website builder, coworker, to include statements that complainant would drive out to meet people. They should contact her. Defendant supplied complainant's address and telephone numbers for the webpage so that she could be reached at home or at her place of employment. And she got calls. And we're back to the same statute. So here, he didn't communicate directly with her. Now we're getting to the other meaning, right, in 240.31. What is it to cause to be initiated a communication? He posted her phone number. For a good time, call X. And somebody did. And he did it with the intent to harass, annoy, threaten, or alarm. So for a good time, call X might in fact be actionable if done in this way. And the conviction was upheld. Now, it's not a serious conviction. It's aggravated harassment in the second degree. And here we have the statute. Now, defamation is a tough one. Because as we hear, there is no federal criminal defamation provision. Defamation is a state claim. And whether it's civil or criminal, you have to look at the extent of the harm. And the particular defamatory statement. So sometimes you have defamation, and defamation is the general sense. You've slandered, libel, but generally speaking, you're talking about defamation. Sometimes it's criminal, sometimes it's civil. So here we have a civil rights claim. Mink versus Knox. What was it that Mr. Mink's, that why was Mink suing Knox for a civil rights claim? What did Mink do? Yep. Oh, I'm sorry, I apologize. Because it went on to defamation. So, never mind. Suffice it to say, it's not actually a defamation case. But it was he was complaining because he had been investigated for what was ultimately protected speech. So we're going to leave that at 613. Thank you for pointing that out. But understand that defamation is another one of these areas. So, until we reach the end. We've done a lot here. I realize you've read a lot, and there's a lot to understand. And I think it's worth, speaking of, looking at our syllabus. Just to go over the topics that we've discussed. So we talked about, generally speaking, the types of violations, the types of crimes that fall into this class's jurisdiction, as opposed to or in addition to falling into general criminal law, criminal process, criminal procedure cases. And the common thread of not only involving computers and the internet, but frequently being possible only because of the use of computers and the internet, or being performed in a unique and a new way not envisioned by pre-computer, pre-internet criminal law drafters. Things that couldn't have been done, wouldn't have been done, or wouldn't have been done in the same way. Theft, copying, duplication, distribution of intellectual property would not have been done for free pre-internet. Being able to remotely alter data, to steal data in the sense of making a copy, to encrypt data and hold it for hostage. Stealing a computer, which is different from other kinds of theft of personal property, because you're not just stealing the physical computer, you are stealing and potentially accessing the data that are on that computer, including perhaps the stored passwords that might give the thief access to other computers. Identity theft. Being able to impersonate someone, or a few million someones, for the purpose of obtaining money, purchasing things without using legitimate funds, etc. International crimes, and so on. All those things where the involvement of the computer and the internet made it possible, made it easier, made it worse, made it different. That's been our common thread. In some situations, we have traditional crimes that have an internet computer spin to them. In others, we have unique crimes. And we similarly, just as criminal activity has changed, so too has criminal enforcement. And in fact, as we see in our syllabus and you look back through your notes, we spent much of really the first half of the semester looking at the law enforcement side, looking at both the new tools and methods available to police and law enforcement officials and government officials, but also the significant challenges existing and new. We looked at the Fourth Amendment over and over and over and over again, I know. But that is the basic principle underlying the permissibility or prohibition of investigative methods. The idea of warrants and when a warrant is needed and all of those exceptions, consent, plain sight, border searches, and those others that I'm temporarily having a mental block, but they're all in the notes, and we did discuss them, all the other exceptions to the warrant requirement, and the challenges. What is it? What does consent mean when you have a shared computer or a computer in a shared apartment? if people have the share of the login or they have different logins on the computer. What does plain sight mean? When you have something on the screen or accessible through one menu or through multiple menus. How far do the rights to a border search go? What are the exigent circumstances? See, I did remember it. And how long do they allow police officers to wait before obtaining a warrant? What does the warrant have to say? Particularity. Another requirement of the Fourth Amendment. How specific, how particular has the warrant had to be? Is it enough to say property when you're talking about computer records? Is it enough to say computers when you're talking about phones? Is it enough to say disks when you're talking about memory cards? And so on. What is the reasonable expectation of privacy in different circumstances? What does it mean to seize, right? That's the search side. What is seizure when it comes to digital evidence? Is it making a copy? Is it taking the device? Is it taking the data and deleting it? Deleting it. Is it undeleting? What does undeleting represent? Does it matter how sophisticated or unsophisticated the defendant is in computer stuff? I didn't realize it could be undeleted so easily. I didn't realize there were temporary files remaining. Is that sufficient to establish that reasonable expectation of privacy that triggers the warrant requirement? We looked at networks in the internet and the issues of internet service providers and their roles in facilitating criminal activity and facilitating criminal investigation. We looked at 18 U.S.C. 1030, and as I've said before, I expect you to be very familiar with that statute, its different provisions, the majority of which follow the same pattern of without authorization or exceeding authorization, access is a protected computer and knowing what those different ands are and that one of them is needed. Also that statute prohibits trafficking in passwords and other kinds of methodologies for getting around security. That statute has evolved. Why it has evolved, looking at the challenges the courts face throughout the semester, the challenges that the courts face. A possible exam question could give you statutory language and say, you know, what challenges might the police and the courts face in applying this statute as written to these particular circumstances? We looked at the issues of intellectual property from a criminal perspective. Where does copyright infringement shift from a civil issue to a criminal issue? And we looked at the criminal copyright statute and the issues of intent, the issues of commercial value, and the issues of pre-release. Things that are intended for commercial release that are copied and distributed without authorization prior to that, and why that is a separate offense from the others. We looked at spyware and malware and spam and phishing, which are often not criminal per se. They may be civil. Not only might there be private rights of action, but we discussed and looked at how consumer protection authorities, the Federal Trade Commission on a federal level, and the attorneys general of the various states use their broad jurisdiction to go after bad actors that are misleading or being unfair to consumers, even when that activity is not criminal or even violating any specific civil law. And whether contract disclosures are enough to protect consumers. The issues of spam and how to define it and where there might or might not be laws about it and against it. Phishing and its implications as a methodology or as a separate offense. And today, of course, we finished up with the discussions of speech-related offenses and whether and how they may be criminal and the limits on those laws. You need to know 18 U.S.C. 1030. You need to understand the Constitution, the Fourth Amendment, and the exceptions to the warrant requirement. Those are at the heart of the second. The Fourth Amendment is at the heart of all criminal law in the United States, whether it's ultimately cybercrime or non-cybercrime. And that's just general important stuff you need to know. But the challenges faced by police and district attorneys and U.S. attorneys and attorneys general and so on in trying to figure this stuff out in real time, to know what's in plain sight, what isn't, and the consequences of failing that. And then the specific offenses, the specific criminal law about computers and the internet. 18 U.S.C. 1030, certainly the criminal copyright statute, and some of the others we've looked at to the extent that we've discussed them. And that's it. You see the common threads. You see how we've been talking about them. I've been very pleased, I'll tell you, that we have had good participation. Not always equal from everyone, but everyone has participated. I've enjoyed the discussions. I've really been pleased to be back teaching this. I'm very interested to hear feedback from Professor Zacharin about her section. I was grateful for the welcome you gave our guest on the 28th and hope that some of you at least have followed up with Mark Zaid. And I wish you not luck, because you don't need it. I wish you success on your exams. Any of you graduating now onto the bar? Good. We'll leave that for later. I'll be available for any questions, so thank you.